So here we are on our last night, last Dharma talk. Happy New Year. I really don't know what I'm going to talk about yet. So we'll see. I have some questions. People left some questions, and I'll try and weave answers to those into the talk as well. Just some things that have come up for me as we've practiced together. It will likely be the topic. Just like to say that the way you've all embraced the practice is amazing. It's I know there's a lot of people here where it's their first retreat, and I just walking outside and seeing people, walking the path, following the instructions. It's just this beautiful, beautiful scene, looking in the windows and seeing people all in different rooms, walking, doing their walking meditation, just sort of all over the area. It was just beautiful to watch. And to know that, what Thich Nhat Hanh said, there's peace in every step, that what you're cultivating is of course mindfulness and what we've been talking about, but it's also compassion and love for the world. What you're doing is for the world, for humanity. In fact, I don't think we'll survive as a species if we don't start increasingly doing this kind of work. Is the inner work. We've kind of overdeveloped the outer part of us. It's gotten ahead of the inner part. It's our master of technology and so forth. It's phenomenal. So I think the it's time for the inner work. And so I'm just watching you all do this beautiful inner work, and what a contribution that is to the world. What social activism that actually is. You may not think of it that way, but it really is. And it not only changes the world just in the practice, but it also equips us for the world to engage with it in a way that changes, and transformation is compassionate change and is possible. Not going into the world as angry activists, but as compassionate activists with balance and clarity. I think that's why I get so moved when I see masses of people practicing, because and young people especially perhaps, it's the survival of the species in so many ways. Is what's at stake. So what I say, meditate like your life depends on it, because it does. It's not just your life. I think it's all of our lives depend on it. So when we're approaching this practice, I've talked a lot about being with what is, moment by moment, what's arising in your interior experience, and just letting it be. And I realize that can be, it's easier said than done in many ways. It's because we get hooked. There's habits, habitual patterns that we get hooked by. And really what we're doing when we're doing this training is reprogramming, rewiring these neural pathways, getting out of these habitual patterns of reactivity. Wiring in other ways of being with what's arising. So really you're just really sitting there kind of doing a rewiring job, if you could put it that way, while you're sitting. And there's actually now, of course, we're doing scientific studies to show that things, particular things are happening. I certainly have found this to be true, in that I suffered some brain injuries and through hitting my head too many times, concussions, and I'd lost so many so many of my faculties, and through meditation they just they slowly, not even slowly, they, to me it was slow, to the physicians it was so rapid that they decided they were going to do research studies on meditation and recovery from traumatic brain injury. So, because to them, 3 months is a short period of time for to go from not being able to balance myself. So I couldn't really walk, couldn't do a lot of things, obviously, to recovering through just by basically rewiring my brain, is the way that they put it. You must have had to bypass a lot of blown circuits in order to get that to happen. So really, I tend to see that as what we're doing in this practice, is just continually coming back to the to what is. And it takes something, a teacher I really respect, and I'll read, he died in 1971, is Suzuki Roshi, a Zen teacher, a Soto Zen teacher, who really kind of brought Zen in many ways to the West, and introduced it in very interesting ways. And he wrote, I think it might be the best-selling book of all time in Buddhism in the West, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. And that word, beginner's mind, is a translation from a Japanese word. In Vipassana circles, we sometimes call it don't know mind, just pointing to the same idea. It's really looking at what's arising with this freshness, like the ladybug. Remember the ladybug I talked about? It still amazes me. I said that image, when I think of beginner's mind, I think that's going to be an image that sticks with me for a while. Just like the looking at the with fresh eyes. Because we can get kind of, there's that breath again, that boring old breath, same old breath. So it's looking at it as, look at that breath, it's a little it's different. It's got this texture, it's got this resonance, it's got this flow. Seeing each breath, because each breath is, in fact, unique. And seeing the subtleties of it. So that was really looking with a beginner's mind, what Suzuki Roshi called the beginner's mind. I think I might have had a quote in here, but it'll take a while to find it. He had so many quotable quotes. He's quite a... So bringing that quality to our formal practice, and I think we can also bring that quality to our lives, to our relationships. And how many times do we assume we know someone? We've got them kind of slotted in. We know what they're going to say next. We know, so we can come to those kinds of, to our interactions with the world, with a beginner's mind as well. Because we don't know. We really don't know. And I think by looking with those fresh eyes, you begin to see for yourself that you really don't know. Because every moment is different. You don't know So I think that way of being with our experience can be very helpful in this practice and in living this practice in our lives. And getting us right down to our direct experience. That's something I've said a lot over the retreat, is it's about connecting with your direct experience, not your thoughts about what's happening. So in the meditation I said, receiving sounds as sounds. If a thought arises about the sound, like, you know, that's a loud car horn, recognizing that that's just a thought. Receiving the sounds, just the sounds, just with that bare, that direct experience. The thoughts are just as thoughts, as direct experience. Because we can get lost in concepts and interpretations of our experience. In fact, for the most part, I think we walk around living in the world, living in our concepts about the world. So this can be a radical shift in how we relate to the world. Maybe really, I know there's some academics here and some people that have done a lot of schooling. It could be really radical for folks that's what gets rewarded, right? Abstract thinking and so forth. This is kind of getting down to direct experience. Rather than living in a virtual reality, to use a word that's, rather than living in the reality that, you know, we can create on the computer screen, we can also live in the reality that we've created in our head through concepts. And really miss the direct, lived fabric, the thusness, the suchness. The Buddha liked that word, suchness. The suchness of life. Where it's alive and real. And it's also where we see through our illusions. So not only is it our life, so if we're not there for our moments, we're missing our life, right? Because that is our life. If we're kind of lost in thought, we're living in our virtual reality. So we're not only missing our lives, but we're also living in an illusion, which also prevents us from seeing the truth, from seeing reality, which is causing suffering. So there's so many reasons to get out of that virtual reality and come home to our senses. It's been said so many that it's coming to our senses, that direct experience of touching, tasting, smelling, hearing, seeing, and cognizing. So in the seeing, there's just seeing. The smelling, there's just smelling. The cognizing, there's just cognizing. I think that's how the Buddha put it to Bahia when he asked, what's this all about? The story of Bahia. Somebody else said, you're just doing everything. Like, what's the big deal? You're sitting and you're walking and you're standing and you're lying down. Everybody does that. What's so special as well? You know, what's different about your practice? I said, well, when we're sitting, we know that we are sitting. When we're standing, we know that we are standing. When we're walking, we know that we are walking. So we're connected again with he's continually pointing to that connection with our direct experience. And so many of the similes and metaphors that he uses are really pointing to that importance. that we see our experience directly, and through that we see through the illusions. See through the illusions of this self, the illusions of permanency, the illusions that we can be happy through satisfying sense desires. So that's getting down to direct experience. It has come up again and again. And I've mentioned the different meditation postures. There's also what's called the four foundations of mindfulness. Some of your heads are nodding, so you've heard of this, the Satipatthana Sutta. It's a whole sutta that's looking at practicing with these four foundations, or establishing mindfulness with these four aspects. So it's their body, feeling, tone, thoughts and emotions is one, and mental formations you could call it, and patterns, phenomenon, personal and universal patterns. So those are two areas where we can practice knowing what's arising in the body. Coming back to the body, we often aren't tuned into what's going on in our body. And as I say often, the body is like a barometer for what's going on around us. It knows things before we know it. There's been lots of experiments where they've shown this, that they've recorded body sensations, and the body is reacting before the person's cognizing about something actually happening, before it becomes a thought. So it is that early warning system as well. So if we're experiencing some pain in our lives, like bodily pain, it's very important to be tuned into the subtle sensations that escalate into that full, discomfort, that pain, whatever it might be. And there are little, the body sends these little messages that often go ignored. It'll be just a little twinge here, and that's kind of your first little tap on the shoulder. And then it can be a little bigger twinge, kind of, let's say headache, that kind of grows and gets a little bigger, and that's kind of a little harder tap on the shoulder. And then it can grow a little more. And if you can see that first kind of sensation and go, okay, the choice point arises. Do I continue doing what I'm doing knowing I'm going to get a full headache, or do I, back off, settle things, shift what I'm doing, and avoid getting the headache. So for that reason, just that reason, the body is very useful to tune into, to understand. So the body as a foundation for establishing mindfulness, a very important place to practice. Somebody asked about dealing with anger. How does one deal with anger in this practice? And I would say the body is a really good place to deal with anger. So to understand, to see, to know anger. Good place to start is the body. How's this manifesting in my body in this moment? Going back to the body. Any strong emotion. Any emotion, strong or not, that you want to understand and know, tuning into the body can be very helpful. I think I mentioned in passing that I did some practice with impatience. So I come from a long line of proud, impatient people. Impatient was also almost glorified. It meant you're going to get things done, right? If you're impatient, that's genetically and environment. That's what transpired as a personality trait, what manifested. So I get this terrible impatience that would arise, even going to like a grocery store and waiting in line. Just be this horrible experience. Some people are nodding, some people are wondering, wow, this is what manifested, right? So the practice that was offered to me was to actually go get one item and stand in the longest line. Right? You knew where this was going. Stand in the longest line and tune into my body. And just get to know impatience. And if there were still body sensations to be seen, and I got to the cache, go into another line and continue to examine it. And do this at least every day. And it's amazing how fast you get to know the landscape, the bodyscape of impatience. And then look at what thoughts are arising with it. So starting with the body, I got to know then, okay, what thoughts are also arising with all these, and thought it was over, right? I did this for like a month, and then God did it. No, now you have to go to do it for another month, and what body sensations are, right? So you really get to know. So now, you know, when patience arises, what it is is a constellation of some body sensations, some thoughts. In fact, they've kind of lost their juice, so it kind of doesn't arise, really. There's maybe little twinges of it, but it's not like that powerful, just because it's been seen and understood and known as just a constellation of thoughts and body sensations with some emotional juice attached to it. So we can get to know any emotion in that way. If anger is what's arising in your life, then I'm not sure I'd want to construct situations that make you necessarily angry, but if that's arising naturally in your life, then that's the time to really practice, to go, oh, there it is. And if you're starting with the body, you'll probably start to feel it in the body first. Oh, there, I feel anger in my body. There it is. And really tune into it, get to know it, get to know the bodyscape, the mindscape of that emotion. Then see what happens. The Buddha would say, "Go see for yourself. Don't believe me. Go and experiment." I mean, people's heads are nodding, so intellectually it kind of makes sense, right? That you get to know it kind of loses its juice. But you really need to then do the practice to see. So you're understanding a strong emotion in that way. So you can really use those strong difficulties, if we want to label them that way, as practice opportunities. I know that sounds kind of like, who wants anger, or who wants impatience, or fear, boredom. But these are all, opportunities to practice, to kind of go, okay, there's something, I feel something there. There's some emotional content, and explore it, investigate it, bring curiosity to it. It can become a real practice. It can drive people around you a little crazy because they kind of expect something, and what they're getting is this kind of like, where's the impatience I usually get, you know? But my wife will say that she loves mindfulness because she doesn't have an impatient husband. But of course, I was also impatient with her, right? Which can be hard on a relationship. So that's, so the body is so important in this practice. The other aspect of the foundations is the feeling tone. And feeling tone is not emotion. Feeling tone is that pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. It's the tone that we get from something. We have the pleasant, we want it, unpleasant, we don't want it, neutral, don't care. It's a kind of an automatic. So every sense experience that you have has an automatic feeling tone attached to it that can be very subtle. But that's what we do. We're feeling tone machines. We just like it, don't care, on everything. And it's personal because it's based on your perceptions. So the example I always use is music. You hear a piece of music, so one person's feeling tone can be, don't like it, unpleasant feeling tone. Another person's can be a pleasant feeling tone. Another person doesn't even notice the music's there. It's completely neutral. So it's your perception. So the feeling tone has nothing to do with objective reality for the most part. I mean, there's some things that can be universally seen as unpleasant. So it's an unpleasant, unpleasant, neutral. And that's your life is all these sense experience. So you have a sense organ, which is the ability to hear. You have the sound. And you have sense consciousness. And you need all three to have what's called contact. Right? Because if you have the sound without the ear to hear it, there's no experience. If you have the sound and the ear, but there's no consciousness of it, then you don't have it's not part of your experience. So you need all three. And when you have all three, you have what's called sense contact. And immediately what happens is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. You have a feeling tone that arises. That's pretty much your life right there. It's just sense contact, pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. And that's really what you're really boiling down. When I say direct experience, that's what you're connecting with, is the sense contact and then the feeling tone that's arising. Sense contact, feeling. And you can just sit there and watch it. Just sit there and watch. Each of the, when I'm seeing that open awareness that we're doing, you can just sit there and it's allowing anything to come in, any of the six sense doors. And then watching the feeling tone that arises as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. You can make that a practice. And just seeing, okay, right now, as I'm talking, there's pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral with the thing. Things that are being said, with sensations in your body as you're sitting here, with thoughts that are arising, with sounds. So the practice is allowing, seeing this with mindfulness. Some people talk about it as a wedge of mindfulness that can go in there, but it's just bringing all this into awareness, being aware that this is going on. Because what happens next is where suffering comes in. All this can happen and there's no suffering. That's direct experience happening. That's just arising based on causes and conditions. What happens next is where suffering comes in. Pleasant, I want it. I want more of it. We grasp. Unpleasant, aversion. I don't want that. I want to get rid of that. And neutral, I'm confused. I don't know what, whether I want it or not. That's greed, hatred, and delusion, and grasping. Clinging, as the Buddha often called it. It's clinging that causes suffering, and that's what clinging is. Grasping onto that pleasant feeling tone, pushing away the unpleasant feeling tone, and being confused about the neutral feeling tone. So you can see how important, like when you look at those four foundations, you first read them, you kind of go, I get body, I get thoughts, emotions, patterns. what's the ceiling? Ceiling tone is such an important foundation of mindfulness to explore. So important, because that's the really where it's the root of where suffering is arising, and it can really be seen. Because if you don't go to grasping, there's no suffering. And you might, and you can become aware anywhere along the line too. You can have grasping can still occur, right? And there's a reaction, and then you go, oh look, there's grasping. A little twinge, oh, there's a little twinge of discomfort, of suffering. Stops there. Or it can go a little further and you can get quite engrossed in it. Or you can go real much further and you, papancha it's called, is the proliferation. Now you start to add stories about why you shouldn't, why you don't want it and all this. So then it starts to expand a little more. But even then you can still bring hold that in awareness and dissipate the suffering that's arising. So it's not like you have to be sort of right there, right at the feeling tone, and I mean that would be the kind of the, if we could be right there, then there'd be no suffering. But we often catch it kind of further down the line. There's a little diagram somewhere that I always like to. Maybe I didn't bring it. Might not be able to see it from back there. It's the top one. So it's got the three little the three little circles, sense consciousness, sense organ, and the sound. And then you have feeling tone coming off of that. And then the little V is the wedge of mindfulness, which is not really a wedge. It's just bringing into awareness at that point, whatever that might be. Whenever awareness arises as a grace, I look at it as nothing short of some kind of grace. That word works for you. Some kind of love from the universe, because the awareness that you're lost in thought just arises. It's just like, oh, that's a grace. Now I can be aware. Well, awareness is now back. You're not lost. You're just not lost in thought for the whole 45-minute sitting. There's these moments where this grace comes down, and awareness that you're lost in thought. Oh, I can come back to my direct experience. So it just comes as a grace. Somewhere along that, you know, along that line, it just arises. And the more you practice it, the more, of course, that grace befalls you. That's what I find. Okay, some of the other. So I've talked about four lines on all these pages. So see why my talks go over 45 minutes. There's just so much to share. You know, I sit and I what. What can I share with this lovely group of people that would be helpful in their practice? And there's so much that comes to mind that I'd love to share with you. I have some questions about posture as well. So this is a good sitting posture. People ask what to do with your hands. Putting your hands on your thighs is fine. I mean, people might have noticed I had my fingers kind of, and I don't even know why they did that. At some point, I got some yoga background. I know it's a mudra, but and it's supposed to keep the energy flowing. But you know, if I start sitting like this, my fingers kind of go together automatically. So, but it's not like you need to do that. Just your hands on your thighs or rest, whatever's comfortable. The only thing I would emphasize is keeping the spine erect. keeping your dignified in some way, whether you're sitting in a chair or on the floor, so not kind of slouched. And you will find you get pain in your body if you slouch much more than if you. And you develop a meditation body. It's kind of like working out. If you want to, you know, you develop particular, I don't know, just muscles and stretch tendons, and your body kind of develops. You get a meditation physique kind of thing, right? And it just over time, because you're going into this posture. It took me a long time. I'm not a flexible guy, like touching my toes and, you know, moving things around is. So when my knees were up like this when I, you know, first started meditating, and I had like three blocks under each knee, and then, you know, after 3 years I could remove one block. Another, just because, you know, so it does develop. It can take months for some people or years for others, but you kind of develop a meditation physique for it. But yeah, just keep the posture simple, but really emphasize that upright spine. And if you have physical limitations, then by all means adapt the posture for whatever your physical limitation might be. You could even ask a physiotherapist, you know, this is what I want to do. I want to sit still in some posture with an erect spine as much as possible. And what would you recommend? Sometimes it involves some supports for the body in different ways. It's particularly back supports. You know, I've seen all kinds of different things that people have brought to retreats, you know, for sitting in a chair, and they've got different supports for their backs and their sit bones as well, just to align them a particular way. They might be sloped this way or they might be sloped that way, and it's kind of through experimentation that you find something that allows you to sit comfortably in stillness for a period of time. So do, you know, you sort of have to play around with it and get advice for your particular body, if that's an issue that you're facing. So somebody asked me about the difference between Vipassana and insight meditation. I don't really think there is a difference. The different labels for the same thing. Deeply seeing is the translation of Vipassana, and insight is kind of the same thing as, you know, seeing deeply. So they're the same thing. Now, different teachers may have different approaches to these. Even within insight meditation, you know, community and Vipassana, you have Goenka, who has perhaps a different approach than Mahasi Sayadaw, which has influenced many people in the West, which different from Ajahn Chah, and you can sort of see how these differences in technique come out of what their practices are. So you can even just take the Burmese teachers that have influenced the West. Pa Ak will talk about, you know, concentration practice and sitting for 2 hours and following the sensation of the breath on the nose, and you won't hear Mahasi Sayadaw talk about that. It's, you know, access concentration, close, more similar to what we're doing here, you know, this open awareness. So there's different different techniques. What I'm offering is probably most closely aligned with what you would get at the Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts, or Spirit Rock in California, Joseph Goldstein, Jack Kornfield, Sharon Salzberg, those, and then all the other, so many other teachers that are teaching through those. There's differences there, right? So I can say that, but you'll get nuances with different teachers. So you'll find with me, I'm really emphasizing a relaxed approach to the practice. So there's some not making it tight. Because I think in the West, we're good at making a job and striving and tightening around things, so bringing an easefulness into the practice. And I think, as from my personal experience and from working with other people, it seems to be helpful. So that's the way I offer it. If other teachers resonate with you, who are much more structured, and you know, you do it this way, then you know, if that's what resonates with you, then that follow that path. It all leads to the same ultimate understandings, realizations. And loving kindness. I'll conclude with a few words about loving kindness. Sort of started there. The talk ends there. One of my favorite quotes from the Buddha. In fact, it's one of the quotes that flashes on my website. It's payattention.ca. It's for our local Sangha, and there's different quotes that kind of flash across the screen. And one of them is, one of my favorite Buddha quotes is, "You, yourself, as much as anybody in the entire universe, deserves your love and affection. You, yourself, as much as anybody in the entire universe, deserves your love and affection." So we deserve our love and affection. We can be hard on ourselves. And he's pointing to, you know, obviously it was a reality 2,500 years ago. This wouldn't have needed to be said, but it's also a reality, I think, today. So really some radical self-acceptance that we bring to the practice. Radical self-love. We're okay. And then bringing that love out into the world begins by loving ourselves, because then we can bring that love out also into the world. And loving kindness meditation is one of the ways to cultivate that sense of love, and it's very useful. The whole practice, I know, is the cultivation of compassion and love. So when we're looking at our directives, all these things we're doing is all about love. But there are these specific practices of loving kindness meditation, and you know, if you research it, there's lots of information and lots of loving kindness meditation. Sarah and Salzburg would be a good place to start in terms of, I know she has one online that just outlines, you know, what it is and what the process of developing, you know, what the phrases are, what they mean, what the intentions are. You're basically just, you know, invoking these phrases of loving kindness towards yourself, towards loved ones, towards people you don't necessarily know but you have contact with, like the cashier at the grocery store, even people that you would define as people you have difficulties with, and extend loving kindness to them if that seems appropriate for you, and then to all beings everywhere, near and far. So it's a practice where we cultivate that. But as I said, I think just seeing you doing your practice, I'm seeing loving kindness emanating from all of you as you're practicing.